RAAF is the second oldest air force and at the forefront of aviation for over a century. Be inspired by our remarkable air crew, maintenance personnel and support personnel who work tirelessly to keep our aircraft flying high and our skies secure. Host Gareth McRae, OAM, explores stories of humble men and women who, with daring and courage, established the Air Force as an Australian icon.
Air Marshal Ray Fennell, AC, is a retired senior commander of the Royal Australian Air Force. He served as Chief of the Air Staff from 1987 till 1992. A graduate of RAAF College, he began his career flying Sabre jet fighters in Australia and Southeast Asia in the 1950s and 1960s. From 1972 to 1975, he commanded No. 6 Squadron, during which time the General Dynamics F-111C Swing Wing Bomber entered Australian service. He held senior staff posts in the early 1980s. Then in 1986, he was promoted to Air Marshal and became the inaugural Vice Chief of the Defence Force. Appointed Chief of the Air Staff in July 1987, Ray was closely involved in the development and dissemination of air power doctrine. He retired from the RAAF in October 1992, following his term as Chief, and was founding principal of the Australian College of Defence and Strategic Studies from 1994 to 1998. Since then, he served on various federal government committees on immigration and detention. Air Marshal Ray Fennell, AC retired. It is an absolute joy to be able to have a chat. Thanks for your time.
My pleasure.
Tell me, you went to Brisbane High, correct?
Yeah, Brisbane State High School.
While you're in that particular school, you joined the ATC, the Air Training Corps. Why?
That was in January 1949. How it came about, previously I'd been at an intermediate school, the South Brisbane Intermediate School. At that school, there were classrooms that were used by Brisbane State High School. And in my final year there, in 1948, those classes from the high school frequently had on Fridays cadets of both the Army and the Air Force. And I'd been following the war very closely from about 1943 onwards, mainly because I had uncles serving in the Middle East and then in the Pacific. And I was much taken with the Air Force. And I saw these cadets and I thought, when I go to State High School, which I knew I was doing the next year, I think I'll join the Air Cadets rather than the Army Cadets.
So what was it particularly about the Air Cadets that attracted you and not the Army?
Oh, just the fact of following the Air Force during the Second World War.
Right.
And the very first jet aircraft I ever saw was in my final year at South Brisbane Intermediate School when a Vampire flew over Brisbane and the pilot was Vic Cannon. Later on, Vic Cannon was CO of 77 Squadron when I was in Butterworth. And I saw this aircraft flying overhead. I just couldn't believe it. It didn't have a propeller. And I thought, I've got to have some of that.
That was for my memories anyway, that was a beautiful looking aircraft with its twin tails. Just unbelievable. Did you ever get to fly one?
Oh, yes. I got over 1,000 hours on Vampires. And Peter Ring and I both flew them because they were the training aircraft at the Applied Flying Training School when Pete came through on 43 course, which was the first course on which I instructed.
Yeah, and of course everyone knows that Peter Ring is the producer and coordinator of all of these podcasts. How did you actually earn a flying scholarship so young? How did that come about?
Well, I joined the Air Training Corps in 1949, and at the end of that year I did both a junior NCO course and then a senior NCO course. I topped the corporal's course and I came second on the sergeant's course. And in the very first year of flying scholarships for the Royal Australian Air Force, I had my name put forward and I was one of the four people chosen.
How old were you then?
I was 15. And in fact, I had to wait until I was 16 before I could go solo in that flying scholarship.
Were they on Tiger Moths?
Yeah, that was on Tiger Moths at the Royal Queensland Aero Club at Archerfield. And I used to ride my bicycle out there each morning, go flying, and then ride my bicycle to school. And at that stage, I was also a cadet pilot officer in the Air Training Corps. That was the very first year of that particular arrangement as well in the ATC, as it was then known.
Okay, and the Royal Australian Air Force College, did you spend time there as well? How did that occur?
Well, after I graduated from Brisbane State High School in 1952, I applied for the Air Force. I was captured by the flying bug at that stage, having completed my training for a private pilot's license the previous year. And then what the Air Force did, they gave me 4 hours a month of continuation flying, which I did over the next 18 months. So by that stage, I had about 100 hours on Tiger Moths, was greatly enjoying it. So I applied for a cadetship at RAF College and achieved it.
You ended up in the Victorian State Rugby side.
That's correct.
From Queensland to Victoria?
No, what happened was I was a rugby league player at primary school and then rugby union at high school. And when I went to RAF College, I was we were in the first grade competition in Melbourne, and I was captain of the RAF College team, and we had a very good side. I represented Victorian Colts. I also represented the RAAF in Victoria, Victorian Combined Services. And then in 55, three of us, all in the same course, six course, Ted Radford, Peter Bolan, and I were all selected for the Victorian Rugby Union team that toured New South Wales.
Did you ever want to continue in that sort of role, in a rugby player?
When I graduated from RAF College, I went to 23 Squadron at Amberley. At that stage, the Air Force at Amberley had a team in the Brisbane first grade competition. So I played in that side. But subsequently, that was, apart from playing in Air Force teams, I didn't ever play representative.
Okay, well, what position did you play?
I played lock.
You said you began your career as a fighter pilot at number 23 Squadron, and you referred to it as the Citizen Air Force. Can you explain what that is?
The Citizen Air Force, there were a number of fighter squadrons in Australia at that time, one associated with each of the capitals except Hobart. So 21 Squadron was at Laverton in Melbourne, 22 Squadron was at Richmond in New South Wales, 23 Squadron, Amberley in Queensland, 24 Malalar in South Australia, and 25 Pierce in Western Australia. So each of the states had a Citizen Air Force squadron, and they had a staff of permanent Air Force, and then they had a number of cadets who went through on flying training and eventually became fully fledged pilots. And they also had citizens who provided the administrative and technical ground crew as well. There was a core of permanent Air Force, and then the Citizen Air Force people met every second weekend. And, quite often because of that, they were known as weekend warriors.
So the Citizen Air Force, as part of number 23 Squadron, wasn't full-time RAAF. Have I got that right?
Well, I'd say it had a core full-time RAAF staff, of which I was one. And then it had these Citizen Air Force people who came in every second weekend. But also they went on camps that generally went for 2 to 3 weeks full time.
Is your next step to number 75 Squadron following that?
No. After RAF College, I was posted to 23 Squadron. From then, I was posted to the Air Force base at Williamtown outside Newcastle, where I did what was then called Operational Training Unit, OTU course. I did that on single vampires, and then I went to 75 Squadron to convert to Sabres, the Avon Sabre. In those days, 75 Squadron was the conversion squadron. Having converted to Sabres at 75, I was then posted to number 3 Squadron, one of the two full-time RAF Sabre squadrons at Williamtown at that time. There was 3 and 77.
Okay. You have made reference to the Gloucester, the Meteor 8, the Vampire and the Avon Sabre. For someone listening to you right now, firstly, who is not in the Air Force, but even someone who was only just in the Air Force, and they sound like what are they? Could you just very briefly give us a description of each of those in terms of the skill needed to fly them?
It was interesting. I'd been trained and achieved my wings flying piston engine aircraft, first the Tiger Moth and then the Wirraway. So when I went to 23 Squadron, it was equipped with the Wirraway, the Vampire Trainer, the Mark 33, and with Meteors. And the Meteor was essentially the aircraft that we were being trained for. So when I came off course, I first converted onto the Vampire, which was the dual Vampire. Then I did two rides in the Mark 7 Meteor, which was a two-seat Meteor. And then for the rest of the time at 23 Squadron, I flew the Mark 8, which was a single-seat Meteor aircraft. And both the Vampire and Meteor had been developed in the latter part of the Second World War. And the Meteor saw service in the Second World War. It was mainly used against the V-1, the Doodlebug, and to both shoot them down, and another technique that was used was to actually tip the Doodlebug over, because the V-1 actually had small wings.
So if you could go up beside it and put your wing against its wing and flip it, is that what you mean?
Yeah, that's right.
Would have been a rather interesting exercise to undertake.
It was also interesting too, in the years immediately after the war, one of the things was to capture the world airspeed record, and a Meteor did that in Libya in about 1946, establishing the world record for the fastest aircraft of the time. It soon gave way to faster aircraft, but it was interesting that at one stage the Meteor held the world airspeed record. It's the Meteor 4. The Meteor 8 was a development of that, and it was the aircraft that replaced the Mustang, the F-51, in 77 Squadron in Korea in 1953.
So the Meteor in Korea came before the Sabre in Korea?
No, we didn't fly the Sabre in Korea. The US flew the Sabre in Korea, and the F-86 Sabre was a very good aircraft in that conflict. It was brought in particularly to oppose the MiG-15, the swept-wing single-seat fighter that the North Koreans were using with Soviet help during that conflict.
So having flown all of those planes at that stage, at some stage, yep, which do you have the fondest memory of in terms of a pilot in a plane?
The Avon Sabre.
Why?
It was just, its performance was ever so much greater than anything I'd flown before. It had some lovely flying characteristics, had a really good comfortable cockpit, had a lovely comfortable seat. Wasn't the world's greatest ejection seat, as we found out subsequently, but I never had to use it for that purpose.
What was its limitation? What did the canopy not open when the seat ejected, or what?
No. First of all, you needed to eject above. Essentially, you would need to eject above 1,000 feet to be certain of the seat going through all the sequences,
sure,
that led to you having a good open parachute above you. The second thing is, and this was truly awful, it happened at Williamtown on three separate occasions, where pilots like myself, who were quite tall, having to eject because of problems with the aircraft, the canopy, which was ejected first before the seat came, the canopy, when it came off, actually dished in. And in dishing in, it hit the head of these three pilots. There were three separate incidents where,
wow,
pilots were killed while ejecting. By the time Pete got to fly Sabres, we'd corrected that problem. And in fact, what happened in the ejection sequence subsequently, the first action in the ejection, there was a bolt that smashed the canopy first. So
right,
the canopy did not come off. You,
sure,
went through the canopy.
Given that you end up as Chief of Air Force, and I don't want to jump to that just yet, but I do want to ask you what I think is an important question. Up to this point, and then of course you go from number 3 Squadron to number 77 Squadron. Now at this point, you would have had commanders above you. Tell us about some of the ingredients that made for a good commander above you, without naming them, and maybe a bad commander above you. What did you learn, and what can you tell me about the skills they had or didn't have?
It really was learning by example. My first boss when I came off course in number 23 Squadron was Squadron Leader Tony Tonkin. Tony was subsequently my CO in 3 Squadron in Malaysia, and subsequently when I was working in personnel after, way later, he was my boss again. He was a very good commander. He had a very good approach to the people under his command. He was thoughtful, and he was especially good in interpersonal relations. So he was highly influential on me on a number of occasions in my career. Another person who was very important throughout my whole life until recently when he died was Jake Newham, who was subsequently my predecessor as Chief of the Air Staff. When I went to 3 Squadron after converting to Sabres at 75 Squadron, Jake was my flight commander. And once again, by example, he was a very, very good person to work for. The other thing that was also important for me at that time in my relationship with Jake, I became engaged to my future wife, Suzanne, at that stage. Jake and his wife really took us pretty much under their wing at that stage. And it was through Jake and his wife, Jo, that my wife, Suzanne, as it were, introduced to social life in the Air Force right. before we were married. It was very kind and very gracious of them as a couple to take us under their wing, as it were, at that stage, and I never forgot that. Jake was also very influential later on in the introduction of the F-111 into the Royal Australian Air Force. You might recall that when we went to pick up the F-111s in January 1973, it was only 1 month after the Labor government came into power after 16 years in opposition. And in opposition, they had been fundamentally opposed to the acquisition of the F-111. And yet here they were in the very first months of their government, having to accept the decision taken by the previous government for us to go ahead with the purchase of those aircraft. And Jake led the team that went over to pick up the F-111s. He was given a very difficult task, given the controversy surrounding the acquisition of the aircraft. But once again, he did it splendidly, interacting very effectively with his two squadron commanders, who were me and Wing Commander, then Wing Commander Jeff Talbot, and also with the people under our command. I've often said of Jake, his style of management, I often said he had a firm grip but a soft touch. We all knew where we were headed, but he used our talents very effectively to achieve the objective. We formed a very strong relationship from then on. Quite often, after we both left the Air Force, I suppose I would speak with Jake 2 or 3 times a week, often daily. It was that style of management that I really enjoyed. Someone who would tell me what the goal was, encourage me to achieve that goal, and then use whatever talents I possessed and people with me possessed to achieve that objective.
Yeah. I know that for some reason, and you're now about to share it with us, you were very impressed with the United States Air Force. How did that impression come about, and what is it about the United States Air Force that impressed you so much?
Well, perhaps you're misquoting me there or misunderstanding me. I had a lot to do with the United States Air Force. I know a hell of a lot about it, but I have mixed feelings, mainly because the two air forces are so substantially different, not only in size, which there's a huge difference, but also in objectives. They were the lead nation in the Cold War between the Western nations and the Soviet Unions and the Soviet Union and the members of the Warsaw Pact. So that put them in an area quite different from us. Also, the United States Air Force is so fundamentally different from the RAAF. I like to point out that particularly when I was a senior officer to senior officers of the United States Air Force, that there were more air forces like ours than there were air forces like theirs. There was only one air force of the size and capability of the United States Air Force, but those of us in air forces of much smaller size and with much different objectives were very different from. One of the problems I often came across was people trying to bring into the Royal Australian Air Force's practices that were appropriate to the United States Air Force, but totally inappropriate to air forces of our size and with our of our objectives.
Can you give us an example of that, Ray?
The United States Air Force was nuclear armed to start with, and consequently the aircraft is in service with them to this day. The B-52 was developed to deliver nuclear weapons of huge size, if needs be, against their major opponent, the Soviet Union. That was totally beyond anything we would have to do with with our aircraft. Just take the F-111s again. The United States Air Force had a variety of squadrons flying F-111s, from the FB, which was the Strategic Air Command aircraft, through to the other F-111s, the E's and the F's and the like, that were mainly in tactical air command. Their roles were substantially different from ours. Essentially, what we did with the F-111 in the 30 years of its service in the Royal Australian Air Force, we were flying the most technically advanced and the most capable aircraft in our region, as a consequence of which anyone seeking to do any harm to us in any way whatsoever, they had to factor that fact into their calculations. And people have often said, well, essentially the F-111 never went to war. Excuse me, surely the aim of a defence force
is not to go to war.
Yeah. What's the point of the last thing you want to do is engage in armed combat if you can avoid it, if you can achieve your objectives without doing so.
Yeah.
It's the sort of strategic vision that I believe that people like Xi Jinping have. He's perfectly adapted to winning without fighting.
Yes, let's hope that stays that way. I don't want to stick with the United States Air Force, but a lot of the people that I have spoken to, current personnel, say the relationship now between USAF and RAAF is quite close, because the people in the United States Air Force feel very positively towards Royal Australian Air Force personnel.
Yeah, and that's true. And a lot of that has to do with the unfortunate events that have occurred in the Middle East over the last 20 years, in which people have seen the capabilities that the Royal Australian Air Force bring to those unfortunate conflicts and are quite impressed. Impressed not only with the equipment we have, but the way in which we operate it. And I think that's very much to our advantage.
Mm. You developed an instructor's guide to instrument flying. Can you tell us how that came about and now how important it was?
Yeah, well, instrument flying is really, really important, particularly for combat pilots who have to operate in all weathers day, night. Now, when I went through on instructor's course, ESAIL in 1962, we did instrument flying, but we were not really engaged in learning how to teach instrument flying. Consequently, when I went to Pierce, I found myself really working hard on that very issue. And I became flight commander in B flight at AFTS about 6 months after getting there. And I set out to, and with this, I was given great encouragement by the chief flying instructor, Ray Fox, to develop an approach using particularly the approach taken then in the United States Air Force to develop an instructor's guide to instrument flying. How to teach people instrument flying. So many of our cadets who failed the course at Pierce failed in instrument flying, and that was not necessarily their fault. I think the major fault was we didn't know how to teach it properly.
Would I be right in assuming that at the era you're talking about, perhaps one of the deficiencies within the RAAF is that it failed too many potential pilots?
Oh, yes, and I've reflected on that since. And I've shared my feelings on that with a number of people in recent times. Many years later, reflecting on what happened when I was instructing at Pierce at that time, I realized that our approach was wrong. And the approach was from essentially way right through the Air Force, but certainly at Pierce from the commanding officer down through. We were essentially trying to find out reasons why we should fail people rather than mentoring and encouraging them and ensuring they went through to graduate. I've written separately that we got people from BFTS at Point Cook who'd been trained on the windshield. They did, I think, about 75 hours on windshield. And they did all the forms of flying, general flying, instrument flying, night flying, navigation, formation flying. And they graduated, fully graduated on wind shields and that. And thinking about it later, given what we had, we were using the Mark 35 Vampire at the time. If we were good enough, we should have been able to get 90%+ of those kids through, but we're only getting about 50%. And too many of them were failing because we were testing them rather than mentoring them.
Do you think it's possible that post-World War II into Korea, you're in a war environment, that those people you're talking about failing more than mentoring, it came about because we need to have them now, we need to have the pilots, we need to make sure they're skillful because we're in a state of war. So that shaped the attitude of the Royal Australian Air Force in the way it sense, well, we'll fail those that we think are not going to make it, rather than mentor them and then take the time and the hope that they make it. Is that a possibility?
It could be. I don't know enough about flying training during the Second World War. I do know we had a hell of a lot of accidents and we had a hell of a lot of people who failed to get through the course. But I don't know enough about how that instruction took place. But I do know that our loss rate was extremely high.
And that is no longer the case, is it? So something's changed.
Oh, yeah, something has changed. There's been a much greater emphasis on pilot instruction technique, how to be a good instructor.
And use the word you've used, mentor rather than fail.
Yeah, mentor rather than merely testing.
Right, let's go to Butterworth, number 3 squadron, during the Indonesian confrontation. Yeah. What can you recall about that?
Well, it was a stance taken by the then president of Indonesia, Sukarno. And he was obsessed with the fact that the former British colony of Malaya was now an independent nation on his border. And he undertook a form of warfare at the sort of lower level known in Bahasa Indonesia as konfrontasi. It was sort of low-level intrusive warfare, intruding special forces into Malaysia, both Peninsula Malaysia and also Eastern Malaysia on the island of Kalimantan. And it was a serious effort and a cause of much difficulty for this fledgling nation. And we, under essentially the RAAF, was under command of the RAF's Far Eastern Air Force, FEAF, headquartered in Singapore. It was an interesting period. The RAAF, although we were involved in all sorts of patrols and being on standby in case of intrusions by Indonesian aircraft, we never really got involved in any direct confrontation ourselves with the Indonesian Air Force.
So what do you think the brief would have been of the Royal Australian Air Force there?
We had aircraft on alert throughout the daylight hours in Peninsula Malaysia. The British had night flying aircraft, the Gloucester Javelin, based at Butterworth, yep, and also at Tengah on the island of Singapore. That was, you know, to confront the Indonesian Air Force if it should try to intrude into Malaysia. When we were subsequently on deployment to Labuan in Sarawak, which is one of the two Malaysian provinces on the island of Kalimantan, we were based there and we were flying border patrols and also standby on in case of intrusion as well. Looking back now on my time flying Sabres at Butterworth, quite often on deployment in Singapore, deployment at Labuan, and also in that period, 78 Wing provided the personnel for 79 Squadron, which was based in eastern Thailand. For a young officer such as myself at that time, that period, not only the flying we did, but also coming to terms with Asia and how very different it was from Australia, and try to reach some understanding of our near neighbours, I found that extremely beneficial to a young officer such as myself.
And did it then shape your attitude and what you then were able to do as Chief of Air Force in terms of the things that you implemented?
Yeah, it did shape my attitude considerably. For example, immediately after being with Flying Sabres in Malaysia and Thailand, I was posted to RAF Staff College, a 12-month course at Fairbairn here. As part of that, I wrote an essay called On Understanding Asia, and that essay won the Hamanson Prize for the best essay of the year and was published in the Military Journal of that time. And I've since gone back and looked at that. That was 1967, so what's that, coming up 60 years ago? I must admit, patting myself on the back, it's a bloody good essay.
You end up in operational command and headquarters. Is that, when did that occur, and what did that give you in terms of opportunities?
Look, that was much later. After a period I spent in Canberra working on the Defence Force Academy project, after that was when I went to headquarters Opcom.
Before that, then, you would have spent some time with the United States Air Force on exchange, is that...?
Yeah, I went on exchange. After Staff College, I was in personnel department in our Department of Air. And that, once again, that was where I was working for Tony Tonkin for a third time. He was... a group captain, I was a squadron leader, then wing commander. And then I went on exchange to Military Personnel Centre at Randolph Air Force Base in Texas. And that was a significant learning experience. Randolph Air Force Base was one of four Air Force bases in San Antonio, and it was the third largest. There were two larger than it, Lackland and Kelly. But Randolph had more people and more aircraft than the Royal Australian Air Force. So yeah, you can see the huge difference. And I mean, Randolph Air Force Base was one of scores of Air Force bases that the USAF had at that time. We were then an Air Force of about 16,000 people. They were an Air Force of 700,000 people. This was during the Vietnam War, and they're considerably smaller now. But that size difference was huge. And the American approach to personnel management was so much different from ours. Takes a bit of getting used to in size and the approaches taken.
Would I be close to the mark by saying, post-World War II, your generation period, that the Royal Australian Air Force was more people-centred than equipment-centred, in the sense that it cared about the team, the men and women who made the team, as opposed to the men and women who were part of the equipment that we provided you? Would that be a difference between the two?
I don't really know, reflecting on it, whether we prized people over equipment. We certainly in recent times have given more emphasis to people than we did in my earlier career. There's no doubt about that.
Sure.
We've come to terms with the fact that without good people, we'll never be a good organisation. I'm not sure that that was quite as marked back in my early days in the Air Force. Now, with the United States Air Force, I don't think it was a great deal of difference. When you get down to it, down at unit level, people are people, and the way in which they approach their tasks depends very much on personal characteristics. Certainly, there are organizational imperatives that impact on personnel priorities and attitudes, but in general, I wouldn't try to differentiate between the United States Air Force and the Royal Australian Air Force on the basis of the way in which they look at and manage personnel.
Let's just jump, if you wouldn't mind, to your time at the Royal College Defence Studies, which is, I believe, aim was to develop strategic thinkers. What does that mean?
Well, there's no doubt about it that there should be an aim to... These are people who are able to think in the long term, able to determine where we need to be 30 years from now, not obsessed with day-to-day problems, but establishing the principles that should be the basis for the way in which we both think and the way we operate. Now, I don't think the Royal College of Defence Studies was particularly good at that. From my point of view, I enjoyed my time there, don't get me wrong. I learned a lot in that time, and there were we had a variety of people from all around the world in that same group of 80 people that I went through in that year in 1981. But really, to be frank, the aim of the Royal College of Defence Studies is to sell the British point of view to the world.
Really?
That's the way in which it operates. That's not necessarily its stated aim, but when I went through the course, that's the way in which it was operated. Subsequently, when I was developing the Australian College of Defence and Strategic Studies, our equivalent of the RCDS, and I did that immediately after leaving the Air Force, I didn't model it on the RCDS at all. I took a totally different approach in putting together that college than what was taken at RCDS.
So how would you describe or define the British point of view in the Royal College Defence Studies? What was it?
I kid you not, Napoleon had them set to rights. They're a nation of shopkeepers. And what the British are very much involved in is selling themselves, their ideas and their equipment to people throughout the world. There's no doubt about that. And you see it too with their defence attachés. Most of their defence attachés, once again in their training immediately before taking up those positions, it's all about interaction with British industry and promoting British industry wherever they happen to be posted to in their roles as defence advisors and attachés.
Okay, well, you're now the principal of the Australian College Defence and Strategic Studies. How are you different? What did you do that was different from that?
We didn't try to sell us. Our aim was not to sell Australian equipment to the rest of the world. We took a quite different approach. We tried to get people to develop a habit of thinking that ensured that they were taking a long-term approach to the way in which we attack current problems. We aimed to do was to get them thinking for themselves about matters that concerned us not only in now, but where we were headed in the future, and how to develop both processes and habits of thinking that thought and developed in that way.
Let's again make another quantum leap. You're now Chief of Air Force. First day on the job. You've had a predecessor, you've known how he worked and what he did and what he thought and what plans he put in operation. What did you think you could bring to the role on day one compared to what had preceded you?
I had a good grounding up until then. Immediately before becoming Chief of the Air Staff, I'd been the very first VCDF, Vice Chief of the Defence Force, running headquarters ADF. And before that, I'd been working in Air Force office. So I knew pretty much the way in which the whole senior staff worked and what was involved then. I also knew months in advance that I was to be the next Chief of the Air Staff. And in the period leading up to becoming Chief, I had been in contact with every previous chief who was still alive to get their views on what it was like in their time as CAS, and I found that very helpful. Also, I had written to all the people at the next level in my command, the Air Vice Marshals and Air Commodores, and set out my particular thoughts and thinking about where we should head as an Air Force. I was determined to involve those people in development of our thinking and the approach that we should take to the tasks that were given us by the government. So by the time I came around to day one, I already had corresponded my views in a whole range of those matters to the people who are now under my command.
So your prima facie method is collaborative leadership?
Yes, and one of the very first things I did, and I did this annually thereafter in my period as Chief of the Air Staff, I took all the senior officers of the Air Force to out of Canberra, out of wherever they were, with their wives or partners as well, and we went to Coffs Harbour. And no staff, just the senior people, and over a period of 4 or 5 days, we talked through all the issues that were in front of us and how we might go about managing those. No notes taken other than any that people want to take, no particular agenda, just a broad outline of what we would be discussing. And I always, as part of that, I always tried to get a senior person of some standing in the community along as a guest speaker at one of the dinners we held there. I remember I had John Button, who was then a member of Parliament. I had Geoffrey Blaney, who was a historian, was another one I had along to address us.
While you were Air Marshal, a Chief of Air Force, if non-RAAF people wanted to interview you or get to talk to you or discuss something with you, were you approachable? Or, like the modern-day Air Force, there are so many layers of bureaucrats behind you that getting to you is almost impossible. Were you a little bit more open than it seems to be the case in 2023?
No, I was very open. I gave speeches and presented papers all around Australia at that time. I can remember things I did the in the bicentennial year. I gave the Blamey Oration down in Melbourne. I gave the Sir Keithan Rossmith Memorial Lecture in Adelaide. I gave presentations at legal conferences in Brisbane, presentations to various clubs in Sydney, Melbourne, to the Royal Aeronautical Society here in Canberra. I just wanted to put the Air Force out there in front of the Australian people in any way that I could.
So can we have too many bureaucrats? Is that a scenario that should be looked at, or the more the better?
I don't know what is meant by too many bureaucrats. There's no doubt about it, in complex organisations such as modern air forces, you need people who others might describe as bureaucrats. I decided to describe them as essential to the effective management and administration of a complex organisation. The use of bureaucrats as a pejorative term I find somewhat distasteful.
So what would you, when you look back, if you had to pick two things that you are very proud about in your career in the Air Force, what might they be, Ray?
Two things. One, I think I was responsible in turning our Air Force into a thinking man's Air Force. And the second thing was I just wanted to make the working circumstances for myself and my staff as pleasant and as productive as it possibly could be through my own personal approach.
Is there one or two things that you really miss about not being day-to-day in the Air Force?
Well, I miss the flying associated with it. That was one thing I did throughout my period as CAS. I remained current the whole way through on aircraft. In fact, the last aircraft on which I did a conversion was the FA-18 Hornet.
Really?
I greatly enjoyed that. So having started on Tiger Moths in 1951, to do a conversion to the Hornet in 1991, that was a reasonable stretch.
What a quantum leap in technology. That is awesome. To a person listening to this chat at the moment, Ray, be they a parent or be a young person, why would you suggest that a career in the Air Force in the 21st century in Australia is a good choice for someone?
Well, to be frank, I don't know all that much about the Royal Australian Air Force at the moment. I'm on the fringes of it, as it were, but I never, from the day I left office in 1992, I've never tried to intrude my way into the Air Force ever since. So although I attend various Air Force functions and what have you, and I'm very much involved as an Australian in seeing what the Royal Australian Air Force is doing, I don't have a great deal of knowledge about the Royal Australian Air Force in those sorts of terms today. On the other hand, I would say to any parent advising their children about service in the Australian Defence Force more broadly, yes, it certainly is a career worth considering. It requires a considerable personal effort to be a member of the Australian Defence Force, but it's an effort that's worthwhile making if you're that way inclined. I wouldn't join it for reasons, as some do, to get a cheap education. I think that is transactional. I would much prefer people to admire what the Australian Defence Force does, except its mission may require them to put themselves in harm's way. And yet I would encourage it on the basis of it's extremely worthwhile personally, and you make some wonderful friends and colleagues through your service.
That part, every single person that I've spoken to from the Royal Australian Air Force, that part everyone talks about with great joy. The friendships, the depth of friendships that you make by being part of an organisation like the Air Force.
Yeah, I have friends that I meet with weekly and have done ever since I can remember. We interact in so many ways. And of course, now with things like the internet, we can contact each other across great distances and do so.
Yeah, just like we have today. I don't want to spend a lot of time on it now, but your post-Air Force career, your work as an advisor on immigration and detention and asylum seeking, that is to be applauded. Do you have a simple way of saying what we, as Australians, we should be looking at in this area?
Yes, I'm deeply disappointed with the approach that successive governments have taken in this area. Rather than being the generous nation that I believe we can and should be, we haven't treated people seeking our help very well at all over this period. I started off immediately after I finished up at the Australian College of Defence and Strategic Studies. I was asked by the then Minister for Immigration, Philip Ruddock, to be member of a three-part team doing a external, they're doing a study into people smuggling. And coming out of that, I then served Philip Ruddock and many other ministers after that in that area of immigration, detention and asylum seeking. One of my major part over the 20 years I was involved in that was visiting detention centres throughout Australia, sitting down and speaking with not only people being detained, but also the staff that were managing them, and working with other members in the various groups, advisory groups I work for, offering recommendations to the government how we can do these things better. But to be frank, too often raw politics intrudes, and the generosity that I believe that we as a rich nation should be able to provide for others seeking our help has not been evident in our approach to these people since. Now, I'm not saying that every person seeking asylum in Australia deserves to be accepted, but the way in which we treat those that we don't accept, particularly in immigration detention centres, has not been either generous or particularly profitable for us as a nation. Mm. Yeah, I've recently had to give evidence in various state Supreme Court cases involving people who have challenged the government over the psychological damage they suffered through being in detention. It's been, I'm glad that I was able to speak my mind on those occasions. That in itself was interesting. I didn't realise it. In all those groups of which I was a member, I'd always sold, always filled, and was determined to accept non-disclosure agreements. I found when I was first given the subpoena to for a case in the Supreme Court in South Australia, that the Supreme Court overturned that arrangement. And so consequently, these people had got hold of all these reports I'd written over the years in which I was quite forthright in my approach to pointing out what was occurring. And they'd been able to get hold of those. And so I was more than happy to speak to those and accept that what I'd written at that stage was what I believed.
And it's important that we stick by our beliefs, and you are to be congratulated because of that, Ray. Could I just say, I mean, your contribution to the now 101 years of the Royal Australian Air Force has been quite remarkable. What you achieved in terms of Chief of Air Force and your collaborative approach is to be applauded. It has been an honour and a joy to be able to chat with you today. So, Sir Air Marshal Ray Fennell, AC retired, thank you for your time.
And thank you for bearing with me through it all.
The motto of the Air Force is Per Adua Ad Astra, through adversity to the stars. Achieving the Air Force's mission is dangerous and sometimes deadly. untold numbers of Air Force personnel perish and are damaged physically and mentally in war, peacekeeping, and civil emergencies. The Air Force Association's work is to provide these veteran aviators and their families with the necessary support services. If you can help with this vital work, please go to RAAFANSW.org.au and look for the Help Us button.